You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. And of course, I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded on a Sunday afternoon, the 29th of March, 2006. And we remain in the Lenten period. I'm very pleased. This is going to be a two-parter, at least. And I'm very pleased to talk about this. 20 years ago, almost precisely, I wrote a book called The Manifestation of Holiness, Heavenly Serbia and the Medieval Idea. I am now revising and obviously revisiting this book, which was an absolute joy to write. Now, I had parts of it on my old website, if some of you may recall, the American Journal of Russian and Slavic Studies. And it has my early writings on Putin and the regime and things like that. And I hope to God, I've actually never seen the printed book before, but what I had online was clearly a semi-rough draft because there's, you know, spelling errors and things like that that I hope I was able to remove. I mean, I'm known for this kind of thing, but I'm known for it because I get bored. I want to move on. Not to mention the fact that I read very quickly, which for the most part is a positive. In this case, it's a negative. In 2006 was a very different time for me. And I was visiting Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey. And there, bizarrely, I discovered a few documents that were really the main cause of this book being written, of all places. And in my acknowledgments, I thanked the librarians there because they helped me quite a bit. Also in those acknowledgments, I thanked Milan Opacic, whose music I listened to continuously through the writing of this book. Serbian folk music always agreed with me. And of course, I said, oh, it's a shame I don't drink Slivo anymore. I could have even been more authentic. But also in those acknowledgments, I say what this book was all about. It's to reply, especially to Branimir Andulovic, not to mention people like Tim Judah or Christos Malonis, who wrote an awful book that I reviewed some, you know, back then. And I said, well, your time is coming. Whether in this age or the next, it's not mine to say. Did the Ustasha succeed in destroying Serbia? Did the Turks? Did the communists? Well, if they did not, neither will you. But God will judge you. Then your pseudo-prestige and your connections to the regime will not help you. They'll be your damnation. So I've always been like this. Sometimes I go back to these old writings and I say, my God, did I write that? But this is a book primarily on medieval history, and that was done deliberately. Branimir Andulovic also pretended to be somewhat of a medievalist as he slandered Serbia. When I read that book, it was so outrageous. You know, Johnson's Law clearly stated that there's so few people who can answer him. I forget, it was New York University Press, something like that, that he's going to be believed. And remember, This was at a time, well, maybe slightly after the time, where Serbia was being denounced daily. And the U.S. military, just a few years earlier, was bombing, as always, you know, civilian centers. And I want to go through it and my revisions and things that have changed from back then. You know, like everything Serbian, its medieval history is about warfare, struggle, disunity, and eventual collapse. It is one of the greatest Christian civilizations in history. And at the time, I termed it ethno-communitarian, very different from the systems around it. Medieval Serbia was likely the most literate of medieval civilizations in Europe, had a political system that had checks and balances, and a legal system that assured justice with very few instances of abuse, at least when a strong monarch was in power. The medieval history of Serbia, as I've said many times, is this, you know, on the one hand, balancing oligarchy versus aristocracy, on the other, oligarchy versus monarchy. If, you know, Aristotle says that aristocracy is probably the best form of government, but it very quickly can become oligarchy or plutocracy. They're the reverse image of each other. Zeta and Rasta, which back then we call them, you know, modern Montenegro and Kosovo, respectively. They were born in strife between Bulgaria and Byzantium. Prior to, and we'll talk about this at some length, Saint Stepan Nemanja, who really was the founder of what we would call the Serbian kingdom. Serbia was important because she was a major contested area between those two partners. Now, remember, the main conduit for Greek thought was the Diocese of Ohrid, who theologically was the ruling metropolitan, and that's how Serbia became Orthodox. But Serbia also had some Latin influence, which is not a bad thing, but you could see that just in really in some of the iconography. When I say Latin, I usually mean Italian. And the Italian city-states controlled the coast. That means that they controlled most of the trade going into Serbia. The whole point here is that Serbia was born in a rough neighborhood, and she very quickly needed to learn how to fight and defend herself. The key trading center was the city of Dubrovnik. The Italians called it Ragusa. That was really the center of the merchant life, the center of the Italian states, and there they wanted to penetrate farther inland. Now, it's true the Byzantine Navy put a check on that development. Their Bishop of Bar was used by the Pope to Latinize the area, using the power of Venice to accomplish this. Zeta was connected to that sea, so it also meant that that region came under papal control. So the main issue was linking trade in the coastlands with dependence on the seas involved. In other words, for the Latins, the establishment of bishoprics, diocesan bishops along the coast, of course had a strong economic component. A component connected very closely with Catholic religious penetration into Serbia. I have a paper out on the relations between Byzantium and Venice, really right up into the fall of the Holy City. But at this time, We're talking about, you know, maybe the mid-12th century. Byzantium retook these areas, and the popes of that period, Callistus II, Innocent II, and Alexander III, they removed the sees of Split and Bar. Those were the two big ones. And then sent all their resources to Ragusa instead. That was a move. It tended to identify the Roman Church and papal control with both landed and merchant wealth. Now, the Latin Rite was predominant there, but even in Roska, it was also predominant. It was under the Metropolitan of Dubrovnik. Really, it was only under Basil I of Roska did the Byzantine Rite emerge between 871 and 872. So you had a situation where the coastal lands were Latin, the interior was Orthodox. In 1020, Basil made Roska a part of the Ohrid diocese. So the three major Serbian states of Roska, Zita, and Zumilia were well formed, but they were at this point under Byzantine control, not Latin control. We're talking about, you know, 11th and the 12th century. And Serbia was always a vulnerable state. A situation shared with most of her Slavic neighbors, which is really where the idea of Yugoslavia came from. These states were not large enough. I mean, Bulgaria at a certain time, I did a lecture on that, may have, but the rest were too small. 924, Simeon of Bulgaria sacked much of Serbian territory. Again, this is prior to Stepan Nemanja in St. Sava. There, you had St. Vastimir of Serbia, eventually murdered by the Bulgarians. Roska did not have a stable government as Zita did. And Zita then became the beginnings of a stable Serbian polity. It became the first building block, so to speak, in building Serbian unity. Roska was a feudal anarchy of what was called zupanets, or petty military chiefs. One of the greatest monarchs, not only in Byzantium, but of all time, is Emperor Basil II of Byzantium. My first son's middle name is Basil, partially for, of course, St. Basil the Great, but he was also named for the emperor. Basil simply could not be beaten, but his successors could. And Stepan Vojislav defeated Byzantium shortly after his death. Basil II destroyed the Second Bulgarian Empire, and then brought Serbia under his rule. Bodin, who died in 1131, liberated Serbia from Byzantium. After his death, it led to further dynastic struggle, and it led to the rule of Uroš I, Stepan Nemanja's grandfather. Now, this gets confusing. There are two monarchs by the name of Uroš I, one prior to Nemanja, one we're talking about here, and one after. We distinguish them by adding Stepan before Uroš. Saint Stepan Nemanja, and remember all monarchs in Serbia were named Stephen. But Nemanja united Zita with Roska, providing providing the first lasting stable government, and he created his own dynasty. He was building the unification of all Serbian-speaking lands. Nemanja maintained a strong position, partially due to the death of the Byzantine Emperor Manuel, very powerful. And like much else in the Balkans, the fortunes of Byzantium were inversely proportional to the drive towards Serbian independence. But even under Basil II, Serbia maintained complete cultural autonomy. At the time, her church was under the Greek see at Ohrid. Byzantium was defeated against a coalition of Venetians and Serbs, which set the stage for a more meaningful concept of Serbian independence. There is no exaggerating the role of Saint Stepan Nemanja. He is rightfully so a legendary figure. He created a unified, strong government for Serbia. And because of that, the economic situation improved. By absorbing Zita into his realm, he checked Latin advances. Zita, of course, remember, is Montenegro. But had the Latins penetrated inland any farther and began to control the economic life of the interior, Serbia may never have come into existence. Or at a minimum, just would have been a permanent vassal state of Hungary, like Croatia in this era, or just a trading outpost of Venice. Nemanja was the Grand Prince until his death in 1196. Actually, I shouldn't say that, because he became a monk shortly before his death on Athos. So not quite 1196. But he founded what would evolve into the Orthodox Serbian Empire, not to mention the National Church. But in 1196, after 3 decades of warfare, including the third Norman invasion of the Balkans, which actually helped consolidate Serbia while distinguishing it from Bosnian and Byzantine spheres of influence, he abdicated in favor of his middle son, Stepan Nemanjić, and technically is the first king of Serbia. Nemanja went to Mount Athos. He became a monk, took the name Simeon, joining his youngest son, later known as Saint Sava, who had already become the first archbishop of the Serbian church. Now, this is a very simplified background history here, so don't, you know, get me on the details. The Nemanja dynasty in Serbia had three aims, three purposes. Internal stability, the strengthening of Orthodoxy, and the expansion of her boundaries, at least for Serbian-speaking areas, for the sake of defense. I mean, all three of these are really aspects of one another. But her strength, both in a spiritual and worldly way, came from Orthodoxy. It became a national marker that set Serbia off from many of her neighbors. The Latins were connected to the banking and merchant allies, not just in Dubrovnik, but also in Italy proper, attempting to subvert Serbian life and its orthodoxy. But in the very act of challenging this drive, had as much to do with strengthening the Serbian state as anything else. Yes, they were speaking the same language, but a sense of nationhood became clearer and clearer as these wars continued. Saint Sava later built monasteries at strategic posts along the western borderlands, and that was a defensive infrastructure against Rome and its Venetian allies, sometime Venetian allies. Only unity saves the Serbs is the national motto. And there's good reason for that, because it was often very rarely to be seen. Stepan Nemanja had to fight his elder brother, Tihomir, to gain control of Roska. Wars between Venice and Byzantium, I mean, they were, again, more or less permanent rivals. Very, very different forms of state. One a landed power, the other the archetypal sea power. And Stepan tried to use this to his advantage, As I said before, the death of the Emperor Manuel made life easier. Manuel's death made Stepan Nemanja the strongest ruler in the area. When Saint Stepan died in 1199, he had three sons, Vukan, Stepan, and Rajko. But Rajko actually took the name Sava in monasticism. Vukan ruled Jita, given Roman Catholic lands, eventually muscled out by his brother Stepan, while Sava went into the monastic life. Now, 1204, the destruction of Byzantium was by far the most earth-shaking development in this era. Not only had the papal powers, but I know it's far more complex than this. I've written on it, I have lectures on it, but it's shown that papal powers had shown their teeth, and they had an appetite for destruction. But the evils that were rained on Byzantium gave both Serbia and Bulgaria room to grow and develop independently. The other side of the coin was that then the Pope was growing in confidence, tripled its efforts on the western coastlands. Under pressure from the Latins, Stepan married a Venetian princess, then a Byzantine one, and he did receive a crown from Pope Innocent III. But the destruction of Byzantium provided the popes of Rome with such leverage that they were irresistible. Again, receiving the crown from the Pope is evidence of this. Serbia was now under one ruler. Stepan I, crowned 1196 to 1228, was also crowned by the Pope, but his brother Sava promised him church autocephaly in exchange for his reconversion to Orthodoxy. So that's how bad it had become. The sacking of Constantinople in 1204, people were converting to Catholicism just out of, you know, they thought that it was finished. Stepan obviously didn't believe Byzantium could offer him anything. So he wanted to be confirmed, as Vukan was. Even Bulgaria was forced to accept control from Rome at the time. And it proves that, in context, without the Orthodox Empire, all would have become papal. I mean, so you have a situation where Byzantium was in a tremendously weakened state. Byzantine Empire had receded to the states of Nicaea and Epirus, Nicaea being far more significant. Slavs were able to wrest independence from these states. However, Catholicism always was a rival, really right up until the great emperor Dusan. But the family had a problem. Vukan, as it turns out, was critical to Rome. He asked Innocent III to make the See of Bar, which was under his control, independent of Ragusa. Venice protested. It still was granted to him anyway, through a council, 1199. Hungary then absorbed this area and began Latinizing the interior. Using Bulgaria, Stepan Nemanja took back the region with, you know, he couldn't have done it on his own. But keep in mind, Stepan was in no manner Catholic. His approach to Rome was dictated by global political events. He went to Nicaea for autocephaly. However, Vukan remained in the pay of the Pope of Rome. I mean, Serbia was a huge prize for the Latins at the time. And they used native Serbs, Ragusans, and Albanians to get what they needed. And they failed. And they failed in large measure because of one man, Saint Salva. I mean, the impetus for autocephaly was the real threat of rule from Papal Rome. The significance here is that in accepting that rule, Trebi would also be accepting the rule of Venetian oligarchy and those serfs loyal to it. Lucan deliberately and openly flaunted his father's will. His father's will was that Stepan should be the sole ruler of all Serbian lands. But Vukan was an instrument of the Pope, and he fought Stepan for control over Serbia from his base in Montenegro. That's when Stepan, when I say Stepan, I'm talking about Nemanja's son, threw in his lot with the Bulgarians, because Vukan, for a very short time, did establish himself as the sole ruler. That Orthodox coalition saved the entire region from complete Latinization. And yet, even there, Stepan was forced to accept a crown from Rome. Bulgaria was wavering in its loyalties. The Pope was allied with the banking houses of South and Western Europe, but none had reached the power of Venice. So the question was more than just true doctrine, but also economic independence. Maintaining the Orthodox faith against the Roman Church, that was a major reason that monks from Athos were chosen as the first bishops of the independent church. And a strong Athenite presence maintained the purity of the faith in Serbia. Afterwards, the reign of Ratislav turned to Ohrid again. Well, of course, you know, Orthodox, it was the Greek competitor to Serbia, and had forced Saint Sava back to Serbia again to stop it, Ratislav being replaced by Vladislav. Ratislav was very Byzantine in his political ideas, even forcing Slavic nobles out of their lands. For him, the Greek Empire was the seat of culture, and the Serbs would, in his opinion, do better remaining under Greek control, Byzantine control. This proves without doubt that the notion of Serbian nationalism existed articulately at the time. Yes, Byzantium was the seat of culture. Vladislav, who replaced him, was pro-Bulgarian. Ratislav was an enemy of the landed classes, though, so I don't want to say anything bad about him. You know, the Byzantine Commonwealth idea, there's nothing wrong with that, which is why he loved the Byzantine idea of a strong emperor. He also was an admirer of the great Basil II. So the Orthodox landlords, or landlords, period, wanted the reign of Vladislav. Now, he was not a tool of the landed classes. I don't want to say that either. But developing the kingship in Serbia was becoming completely Byzantine, reaching its apogee under Tsar Dusan in the early 14th century. However, there was another problem. So the next goal was the elimination of Hungary and Bulgaria as military threats. The situation had changed since the Crusaders sacked the royal city. Now remember, they had no idea how to run a place like Byzantium, let alone a city like Constantinople. They had absolutely no clue. The economy was destroyed, and they did absolutely nothing to change that. They tried to keep some Greeks on, you know, as accountants or whatever they were for. But in the 1270s, Byzantium was restored. So the Bulgar alliance wasn't necessary. However, at the same time, Bulgaria came under the great czar John Aston. The landlords were upset with the man they thought they could use, Vladislav, replaced him, and sent Uros I as his substitute. He was a man still ruling justly for 30 years. He created a stable and prosperous state. He was the one who brought German miners to Serbia to work the mines in exchange for high pay and total cultural autonomy. I cannot stress the importance of the mines. This was the heart of the Serbian economy. He also maintained good relations with Dubrovnik. I mean, they were always fraught with danger, but that's the price of prosperity. Again, let me remind you, Serbian rulers count their names from the first crown, as if this is complicated enough. I'm now talking about the second Uros I, or Stepan. The first was prior to the crowning of Stepan, the later afterwards. Uros I was one of the greatest rulers of the medieval Serbian kingdom. His long reign created a stable situation for internal consolidation, the coining of money, which comes directly from the development of mining. And he was able to pacify the arrogant Ragusan lords, which means that he was able to ensure the use of coastal trade for Serbia's benefit. So as Byzantine power was sort of restored, Hungary became more powerful. And Uros lost a major battle against the Hungarians. Because of this, he was replaced by his son Dragutin. Still, though, mining was growing tremendously. This is why Serbia is one of the most prosperous states of medieval Europe. After a fall from his horse, unfortunately that crippled him, Dragutin was replaced by his brother Milutin, who continued the same policies with the reign lasting another 30 years. Milutin, for some reason, is my favorite Serbian monarch. I have his icon hanging in my office. Milutin also had been dissatisfied with his father's policies that were very Byzantinist and demanded a single ruler for Serbia. But in order to do that, he had to ally with the landed class. But they didn't trust a single ruler who might interfere with their privileges. But he continued the process of unification. He set the stage for the Emperor Dušan, and Dušan really was the only one who could call himself emperor. The two brothers fought for years. They eventually reconciled. So Milutin was, you know, Uros II Milutin, dying in 1321. He's responsible for a tremendous economic expansion, and not just in mining either, but agriculture too. He became one of the most powerful European monarchs of his day. He was allegedly married 5 times, and yet he was still canonized. I don't fully understand that, but it doesn't matter. Part of the Adriatic coast had been taken from Byzantium, Byzantium was never quite the same. I think we all know that. What the so-called Crusaders did to Byzantium, the Holy City was never quite the same again. And under Milutin, you could probably say national unity was achieved. The landlords essentially were very sympathetic to the Pope. Landlords of Albania especially tried to, you know, were used to try to topple Milutin, but it failed. Under him, Serbia became a first-rate power, based around mining, advanced agriculture, and international trade. Serbia had no choice, however, but to operate with the Ragusan oligarchy, which was very closely allied to Venice. They couldn't function any other way. There was a coup attempt against him in 1319 that directly came from the Pope of Rome. There's a written order. The landed nobility tried to overthrow him. That same nobility had become Latinized in many respects. They believed that the banking oligarchy in Catholic Venice would serve their interests far more than an Orthodox czar like Milutin. So we're starting to see the development of the populist nature of Serbian royalism in the Middle Ages, about checking the power of the Venetian oligarchs, the Pope, and the landlords in the area, and even Serbia proper, who sought alliances with the Western banking powers. Uroš III, Stepan Dukanski, who reigned from 1321 to 1331, he was actually blinded by his father Milutin during a rebellion, one of these rebellions by the nobility, but through an appearance by St. Nicholas was miraculously healed. The nobles tried to turn Milutin against his son, but after he was healed, relented and pardoned him. Problem was, you have the Second Bulgarian Empire under Samuel. It was crushed by the Serbs. Bulgaria was even occupied for a year, 1330-1331. Uros III defeated Andronikos, weakened during the civil war in Byzantium. Now, that the official reason Dušan overthrew Uros III was because he didn't pursue the wars with greater energy. He wanted to press the borders of Serbia even farther south. Uros was murdered for his restraint and was canonized as a martyr against Dušan. But Dukanski is known for his defeat of Bulgaria. But still, the creation of a long alliance between the two states, really until the Turkish conquest. Despite all these wars, given the nature of their enemies, relations between Bulgaria and Serbia, generally speaking, was positive. Were positive. They were using each other to check the Latins and the oligarchy. Dušan, the Emperor Dušan, was a different story. His followers were more warlike than those of Uros. Dušan rapidly expanded the borders of Serbia. Those who were not Serbian-speaking, and this became a problem, they were permitted to maintain everything. That was pretty normal. It was also a Roman custom, maintained in Russia, maintained the Roman concept. Yes, Dušan came to the throne by murder and deceit. He was a just ruler beyond that. He had married into a Bulgarian royal family in 1346, was able to play Hungary and Byzantium against one another. He even claimed the succession to the Byzantine throne at one point, which, by the way, was accepted by Venice, Ragusa, and many bishops in Greece, Bulgaria, and even Albania. Salonika, a huge port city, Greek-speaking, considered switching to Dušan, given the manifest unpopularity of John Kentakouzenos, who was then the emperor. But yet again, you had another civil war in the Byzantine Empire, with the Turks taking the side of Kentakouzenos. Places like Albania, Macedonia, and parts of Greece fell to Dušan. I shouldn't even say fell. It was, for them, was considered a positive concept. The archbishops of Pesh and Ohrid raised the Serbian archbishopric, founded by Sava, to that of a patriarchate. The Latins obviously never trusted him. He was simply too powerful for Venice to manipulate. Dušan banned the Latin Rite in Serbia. Latin clergy residing in Serbia were considered an advance guard of Venice, Hungary, or Ragusa. Now, I have a paper. It's a paper as well as a lecture I gave here in 2023 The Serbian Apocalypse, the story of the Balkan Despotate and its defense of Serbian independence, 1402-1459. At this point, I recommend you consult it. The Despotate has always interested me, and I finally put my thoughts on the matter to paper. Because we're getting into that, but I'm going to very quickly go through it. Dušan died a very mysterious death at the age of 48, 1355. His successor was very weak. Dušan had placed, of course, strict limits on the powers of the landed nobility. So after his suspicious death, they began to coin their own money. They began to rule independently. They tried to institute serfdom to a country that had never known it. He was likely murdered by Vatican agents. He did have the potential to lead a unified Serbia and retain the landlords. I'm talking about Uroš V. The Vatican strategy was to use Dušan's death to dismember Serbia, selling the remnants to Ragusa and Venice. And now you have what might be called the ruin. The strong to the local lords were Lazar of Rudnik, Vukas, and Aprilep. So there was a league against the Turks. And if you read my paper on the Despotate, yeah, the Turks were in Europe because they were invited. Short-sighted rulers were bringing in Turkish infantry to settle scores, having no conception of what this could lead to. And that's really my article in the Despotate is really based around that concept. So the League Against the Turks were formed from Hungary, Bulgaria, and Serbia. Vukasin was killed and actually broke this alliance to pieces in 1371. Lazar retreated to the far north. He made his capital at Kruševac. Lazar was of kingly stock. He was related to Dušan. He was more powerful than the western supporter of Vukasin. He controlled many mines in the north of the country, maintained at a reduced scale the highly literate and cultured life of medieval Serbia. He created a new alliance, which included Byzantium, which defeated the Turks in 1387. But of course, the next meeting was the fateful day, June 28, 1389. Stepan Lazarevic, who died in 1427, this is part of the Despotate. Hungarian pressure forced his mother to establish a vassal relation with Hungary after the Magyar attack on Serbia in 1389. Tamerlane had given Byzantium breathing room from the Ottomans because he had come in and smashed the Ottoman state. John VII, Byzantium gave Lazarevic the title of despot. He maintained good relations with Turkey in his war with Hungary. And that relationship helped him regather the former Serbian lands. So Branica alone was responsible. You know, the importance of the mines, 30% of European silver came from that one town. The mining laws were very strict. I mentioned it already, but pay was very high. In fact, the prosperity was such that it was able to actually challenge Venice on those grounds. George Brankovic, who died in 1456, upon Lazarevic's death, was forced to cede lands to Hungary and even Turkey. He had to become a servant to the Turks because of his weak position. Serbian losses, low morale, was rotting the basis for any kind of concerted military action. Smederevo became the new Serbian capital, close to his mines and mints. Yeah, much of old Serbia was controlled by him. Murad II, however, of Turkey, made war on him and destroyed his capital. George organized a crusade against the Turks with the aid of the Hungarian princes Ladislaus and Hunyadi, 1438. The Vatican went back and forth. They always wavered. When I say the Vatican, I'm talking about, you know, the northern Italian city-state and the Pope of Rome. So I'm using it kind of loosely. So they wavered, of course, between converting Serbia, on the one hand, and defeating the Turks on the other. Turkey was defeated, and much of Serbia was restored, but it didn't last. Later crusades saw Ladislaus killed and Hunyadi barely escaping. 1453, Byzantium fell. The Serbian mining town of Novo Brdo fell in 1455, the main mining center, which meant that, you know, the destruction of Serbia's mining, its mineral well, meant the end of Serbian economic independence. 1459, Smederevo fell, and independent Serbia was no more until many centuries later. Now, at the time when I wrote this, I thought the history was important. Serbia didn't come from nothing. It didn't come from nowhere. I went through a billion sources to put together, almost cobbled together, a solid history of medieval Serbia, or, you know, the medieval Balkans. And frankly, I had a great time. Which is, you know, weird, but I did. But the whole question was, and of course I don't remember, but I simply asked the question, why did Serbia develop the way it did? Why and how did Serbia, a relatively small state, squished among Bulgaria, Venice, Hungary, and Byzantium for most of its history, rise to become one of the dominant states in Europe under Milutin and Dušan? Well, to some extent, I have, you know, more or less answered that question in a very simplistic way. But I have, at least back then, seven specific reasons. The first, the long reigns of Dragutin and Milutin, as well as Dušan. Long reigns from a just ruler provide any country with strong leadership. It provides it with stability necessary for internal consolidation. It is absolutely essential to development. The Russian 19th century shows this. Ivan IV in Russia shows this. That stability at the top cannot be underestimated. And even the enemies of Serbia realize this, trying to, you know, overthrow or kill these guys on a pretty regular basis. Second, and this probably doesn't have to be said, but Serbia is atop some of the world's greatest silver mines, which gave Serbia its name. That didn't hurt. And the far-seeing concept of bringing in German miners, Saxons in particular, who had been mining for a very long time. This was one of the, if not the dominant, major impetus for Serbian prosperity. It wasn't just silver, though. Serbs mined platinum, gold, and tin, which meant that the balance of trade of the Serbian Empire was always positive. The German miners, as I've said before, were treated extremely well. I mean, it made sense. If this is the source of your prosperity, they were under the emperor's control. So they had a series of mining laws that made, you know, if you're from Saxony, you come from a family that's a long history of mining, going to the Serbian Empire was not a terrible idea. Third, the establishment of an independent Orthodox Church was very important. Not to mention, that was done through the use of Athenite monks from Hilandar. Of course, what still exists today as a Serbian monastery at Athos. They were used to maintain the purity of Orthodoxy. And it marked Serbia off from its neighbors. The Athenites, the strictest, most traditional of all Orthodox, and the dependence upon them in the founding days of the Serbian Orthodox Church provided Serbia with a highly literate, very sophisticated, and deeply ascetic spiritual vision. Again, cannot be underestimated. This is not to say anything bad about Ohrid. That was also a highly literate area. Monks on Athos, reading and study was a central part of their entire world. Fourth, and this control over Dubrovnik, more or less control over Dubrovnik. Dubrovnik/Ragusa. It is intimately tied to the development of medieval Serbia, and it's done for two major reasons. It provided the major outlet to the Adriatic, and hence the world and global trade. And second, the wars fought with this pro-Venetian city, essentially a city-state, kept the Latins in check. And if they were kept in check, then so were their landed instruments in Albania and throughout Serbia. The concept of the merchant mentality didn't exist much in Serbia. You know, in more modern times, after World War I, trying to keep Serbia landlocked was very important for the West. Many of you know what happened in Montenegro over the last, I forget when that was, a decade ago. Montenegrins, of course, who are Serbs in every way. The EU rigged a referendum, and they were barely able to get 52%, I guess. Because very few people voted in that, they kept having it over and over and over again until they got the result they wanted. Six years ago, I have a three-part lecture series on Montenegro, and I strongly recommend, it's one of my favorites, one of my favorite broadcasts I've ever done, especially their level of militancy and violence. You know, they had no choice. You have a minor city-state. I mean, Dubrovnik was no Venice, but it had some of that mentality there. So Serbia had absolutely no choice but to work with it one way or another. Fifth, I know we usually talk about social forces, you know, the working class, the banking empires, but strong individuals matter. Serbia was blessed with wise, far-seeing, and very literate rulers. And the same names crop up over and over again. Stepan Nemanja, Dragutin, Milutin, Dušan, Lazar and his son. These were saints. These were statesmen. These were nationalists, to say the very least. And had these men not been far-seeing, And had they not been imbued with a strong sense of religious and ethnic nationalism, sense of mission, Serbia would have been carved up by local lords in alliance with the Vatican, Hungary, and Venice. Which I'm sure would have, would suit moderns perfectly well. But the world would have been much poorer as a result. Serbia had a disproportionate number of its rulers being great men. Which should say something about society as a whole. Sixth, and of course I hate to say it, it's almost not right to say it, but the sack of Constantinople in 1204 by Venice, her mercenaries, that's what permitted the Slavic nations to have some breathing space. That's where they developed their institutions, that's when they consolidated internally. I mean, relations with Byzantium for both Serbia and Bulgaria, they were a mix. On the one hand, most of its religious and literary culture, theology, derived from the Greeks, usually through Ohrid. The political vision of a strong monarch controlling the land and interests also, in the Balkan context, is of Byzantine origin. But on the other hand, Byzantium was an empire. And it was humane to its subject peoples, had a problem, obviously, with separatism. Byzantium had to deal with nationalism consistently. I mean, these are all Orthodox peoples. But the Serbian ethnic idea was well developed. Unfortunately, the sack of that city meant that Serbia could become an independent kingdom. It developed its own very specific Serbian Orthodox institutions and structures, which we'll be talking about. We'll be talking about this next time, part two. Lastly, I mentioned powerful personalities, but there's one in particular, Saint Sava. His personality was so great, so towering. Few nations can boast of any kind of equivalent. Saint Sava was one of the most extraordinary men in European history. He was a first-rate statesman. He was an ascetic. He was an administrator. He was a creative thinker. He was a tremendous negotiator. And he had an awful lot of common sense. And all of that rolled into one person. Even anti-Serb writers tend to show their admiration to him, as a man. Both Bulgaria and Serbia venerate him very highly. And Saint Sava, of course, the patron of all of Serbia, is still highly regarded throughout Orthodoxy, whatever the ethnic background might be. Sava created the first independent Serbian Orthodox Church. And he's the man who selected his bishops from Mount Athos. He quelled rivalries with his brothers. He preached unity, but only within an Orthodox context, of course, and usually in an ethnic context. I don't want to diminish the role of things like, social forces, classes or other groups, but this man was extraordinary. You ask me how Serbia developed, the way it did in the Middle Ages, Saint Sava is one of the dominant reasons. To this day, Saint Sava has become synonymous with Serbian resistance, independence, and no question, Serbian nationalism. And the role that he played in the creation of medieval Serbia, like his father, Saint Stepan, creating the dynasty of the name for him, Nemanja. Manić is towering. I'm not sure what other word to use. It's extraordinary. Now, the way my book was written 20 years ago, I dealt with the history first, and then I dealt with their communal ethnic organization, the specific institutions politically and socially that made Serbia unique. And then I got more specific. I dealt with the law code of Dušan. Dušan's law code is really an extraordinary work for the era. And it's really hard to talk about medieval Serbia, well, I should even say Renaissance, early Renaissance Serbia, without mentioning it. And it was very influential even outside of Serbia. The epic poetry, which I'm not going to get into, but it has more to do with the creation of the Serbian ideology. Then how to bring it all together again. But again, as it comes to the towering figure of St. Sava, remember, born 1173, and his connection with Mount Athos. I don't think there's an Orthodox empire closer to Mount Athos than Serbia, especially one specific monastery. His father, later in his life, became a monk at Athos. Power is a burden. Power is uncomfortable. Power is not something that anyone should seek. And he was very well received when he got there. Saint Stepan Nemanja, he became a negotiator with Byzantium from Vatopiedi Monastery. However, he preferred to live basically alone. I understand the way, you know, the way I'm speaking. I mean, there was nothing wrong with Orthodox Bulgaria, nothing wrong with Orthodox Serbia, nothing wrong with Orthodox Byzantium. However, there were tremendous rivalries. And after the Fourth Crusade, yes, there were many opportunities for Balkan states. But it's also true that the Fourth Crusade gave Venice and the Pope a tremendous sense of confidence. The Pope made inroads into Serbia after the sacking. This is why the Orthodox threw in their lot ultimately with Bulgaria. Initially, although Serbia did benefit from it, but initially, Serbia was split along princely lines, Montenegro kind of going its own way. And that's where Sava yet again was asked to return home to restore peace. Sava brought his father's remains back to Serbia, and that is something very powerful. It brought peace between the two brothers, Stepan Vukasin. There's also the myrrh streaming and incorrupt relics of the first Nemanja, St. Stephen. Now, his home base there was the Studencia, but he traveled extensively throughout the country. As I said before, he was monastery building had had numerous purposes. It wasn't just for the sake of building a monastery. They had defensive purposes. It was an infrastructure. In fact, it was the infrastructure of Orthodox ethnic nationalism, closely connected with Athos. The other problem with 1204 is that people receiving crowns from Rome thinking that there was no other option. So Sava again had to return home to shore up Orthodoxy in the country. Byzantium accepted Serbian independence, ecclesial independence, was that they needed a strong pro-Byzantine and Orthodox country to help them fight the Latins. And St. Sava was astute. He knew enough politically to understand the position of the Empire of Nicaea. I'm talking about Nicaea here, not necessarily Byzantium in the normal sense. I've also spoken of the Empire of Nicaea, how extremely well it was run. Some time ago, I don't remember how long. However, Slavic churches benefited from the waning of Byzantine power. Nicaea was able to extend its influence by granting freedom to ethnic churches. To them, ethno-nationalist churches in Serbia, among others, that was a structure to fight heresy. Patriarch in Nicaea was granted that same power as the patriarch in Constantinople was. And the concept was, and this has been called the Byzantine Commonwealth, Serbia, Bulgaria, Russia, they can be completely independent of the Greeks while still being a part of this cultural commonwealth. Yes, Byzantium began to grow again, but they also made an agreement with the Latins at Laon in 1274 for a union. It was only the independence of the Slavic churches that allowed that to not penetrate into the Balkans. Laon, Florence, these councils rejected by the overwhelming majority of Orthodox people, because everyone knew what they were for. Sarmalutin, the rapid development of mining power, coining silver, provided Serbs with economic independence. You couldn't have had Dušan without Uroš and Milutin. Under Dušan, actually, Ohrid was absorbed. Bulgaria was neutralized both by war and Dušan's marriage to Helena of Bulgaria. Dušan was consecrated and emperor in 1346 by the new patriarch, Eustathius II. There was a delegation from Athos there. The Bulgarian patriarch was there. This wasn't just an idiosyncratic move. Yes, Callistus, who was the Greek patriarch, they did excommunicate the Serbs. It wasn't taken seriously. Unfortunately, in 1355, Dušan died, and with him, the leadership needed to maintain an Orthodox empire. Prince Lazar of the Morava River Valley, and Patriarch Sava IV, and Isaiah, the mystic of Athos, this is what saved the country later on. Anyway, we will have part two next week, building and revising this book from 20 years ago. I'm very happy to do it. To this day, it has to be providential that I found these documents at Fairleigh Dickinson University, of all places. And they weren't even filed correctly. I found them by accident. Lord God. It was providential indeed. And those documents changed my whole view of the matter, and that's where this book came from. And the librarians at Fairleigh Dickinson at the time were extremely nice to work with, and they also thought, oh, this is crazy. Where did this kind of stuff come from? But next week, we're going to talk about the specific Serbian institutions. I always call nationalism the building the structures of survival. And we're going to talk about the Serbian structures of survival and how they functioned. It wasn't a very, very just place to live. And we'll get into that in some detail next week. Thank you again, my friends, for listening. Bye-bye. Thank you.